most looking forward to when like the doors officially open?
Just looking forward to everybody coming out, showing support, just seeing everybody's faces here, familiar faces, new faces, just everybody enjoying matcha, coming together as a community. I think that's very important. You know, whether there's a line around the block or whether there's 10 people there, I'm just happy to be able to serve our community and serve great matcha to everybody here in Portland.
And what will your hours be looking like once you're officially open?
Yeah, most likely 11 to 7. Maybe on the weekdays it changes and weekends it changes. We might extend our hours on the weekends because the sun's out. But yeah, we're going to look to stick with 11 to 7 and then adjust from there and see how that goes.
Is there anything we didn't cover that you want to mention?
No, we're just, for everyone listening, we're just really thankful for the community. If you like matcha, you like coffee, please stop by. We're located at 555 Northeast Cooch Street. And yeah, that's pretty much it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was great.
For KBOO News, this is Lexis Ponce.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 24, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Lexis Ponce, Kenny, and Dejon. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Brian Bull, Tramel Gomes, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The Abrego Garcia case, innocent but still confined. In peace talks, all the U.S. pressure is on Ukraine, not Russia. And for Israel, a new war in Gaza. First, the Abrego Garcia case, innocent but still confined. Senator Chris Van Hollen took it upon himself to visit a Maryland constituent, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, wrongly imprisoned in El Salvador. After being rebuffed by El Salvador's vice president, Senator Van Hollen's persistence paid off April 17 when he was able to meet with Abrego Garcia at a hotel. Abrego Garcia seemed to be in good health. The vice president acknowledged that Abrego Garcia had not committed any offense in El Salvador, but both he and President Bukele said the government would not release him to return to the U.S. And as for President Trump, well, I'm not involved, he said with a straight face. To Van Hollen, the case is not about one man. Quote, it's about protecting the constitutional rights of everybody who resides in the U.S. At this moment, the administration's position is that Abrego Garcia will never be returned to the U.S., and two federal judges are weighing contempt citations against administration officials. As for the Trump administration's justification of the deportations of Venezuelans on grounds of their gang affiliation and ties to the Venezuelan government, Trump's own National Intelligence Council has disputed it. The council's secret assessment in early April, a consensus of 18 intelligence agencies, is that the Venezuelan government is not directing an invasion of the U.S. by the prison gang. When asked about the findings, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, that's Tulsi Gabbard's office, dismissed it as the work of deep state actors in conjunction with the media. Of course. On Monday came a new development, an offer by Bukele to Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's president, for a one-to-one swap of prisoners. I want to propose a humanitarian agreement that includes the repatriation of 100% of the 252 Venezuelans who were deported, in exchange for the release and surrender of an identical number, 252, of the thousands of political prisoners you hold. This is what Bukele wrote in an ex post directed at Maduro. The freed Venezuelans would therefore include political opponents of Maduro, as well as a number of non-Venezuelans. Maduro has previously accused Bukele of kidnapping the imprisoned Venezuelans. According to a Venezuelan watchdog group, its prisons hold about 900 political prisoners. Bukele's prisons also hold political prisoners and other falsely accused, according to human rights groups. In peace talks, all the U.S. pressure is on Ukraine, not Russia. In a speech, Secretary of State Rubio said the administration will soon have to decide whether or not to continue pursuing a peace settlement. He said Mr. Trump has spent 87 days at the highest level of this government repeatedly making efforts to bring this war to an end. We are now reaching the point where we need to decide and determine whether this is even possible or not. If it's not possible, said Rubio, if we're so far apart that this is not going to happen, then I think the president's probably at a point where he's going to say, well, we're done. We'll do what we can on the margins, end quote. He described Trump as feeling very strongly about this. Rubio acknowledged the difficulties of getting agreement, but said, quote, no one's saying this can be done in 12 hours. Well, that's right. Trump said it would take 24 hours. The short answer is that it isn't possible to get a fair agreement so long as the U.S. doesn't put pressure on Putin. The Russians are surely mocking Trump in private as they continue bombing Ukraine civilian targets with nary a word from the felon-in-chief. As Trump said, he's, quote, the apple of Putin's eye. So despite various comments expressing concern about how Russia is slow-walking a ceasefire, all the pressure is on Ukraine. Just yesterday, both Trump and Vice President Vance harshly criticized President Zelensky for holding up peace talks by rejecting Ukraine's recognition of Croatia as Russian land. Trump won't entirely walk away from Ukraine. He still wants its minerals. The U.S. and Ukraine signed a memorandum of understanding on April 18 as a, quote, step toward a joint economic partnership agreement, according to Ukraine's economy minister. Next, for Israel, a new war in Gaza. From now on, said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a televised address on March 18, negotiations will be conducted only under fire. What he meant is that there would be no more ceasefires in Gaza. Israel's only aim is the destruction of Hamas and reoccupation of Gaza. Negotiating over hostages will only come after total victory. One of the leading far-right cabinet members, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, said freeing the hostages was not the most important war aim. Rather, the aim is eliminating Hamas and taking over Gaza. Writing for the newspaper Haaretz, David Rosenberg correctly observed that while Netanyahu may say he wants the hostages home, quote, resuming the war for him is largely about keeping his coalition together, unquote. Rosenberg writes that unlike the first war from October 7, quote, this second war in Gaza is not nearly as popular as the first one. A survey conducted in late March by the Tel Aviv-based Institute for National Security Studies found that just 28% of the public supports a land war in Gaza of the kind that is now underway. Another 29% supports aerial attacks only. 37% oppose resuming the fighting at all. More than half of respondents think Netanyahu started up the fighting again for political reasons. The army has so far refrained from ordering a massive call-up of reservists. According to a Haaretz report, many reservists have told their commanders that they won't report for duty if they receive orders. The resistance is not just about opposition to the war or distrust of the government. Repeated call-ups have disrupted the lives of many reservists and hampered careers or business ventures, unquote. So here's the situation now, quote, the army occupies about half of Gaza, mostly in an expanded buffer zone along the border, but also in two east-west corridors that divide the territory into three parts. Some 390,000 of Gaza's 2 million people have been displaced, according to the United Nations, and humanitarian aid to the Strip has been halted. Again, unquote. Hamas is putting up little resistance, and no Israeli casualties have been reported. In other news, the U.S. is weighing continued military presence in Somalia. The New York Times reports that the Trump administration is divided over the question of continuing or withdrawing from the Islamist insurgency that has gripped Somalia. Some State Department officials are said to favor closing the U.S. embassy in Mogadishu and withdrawing some U.S. military personnel, while other officials in the National Security Council support continuing the U.S. counterterrorism effort there. Up to now, after decades of effort, U.S. support of the central government has little to show. The insurgency, led by al-Shabaab, remains very active, and the government remains deeply divided by clans and is quite unstable. Memories of disasters in Libya and Afghanistan haunt this debate. Norway has a dilemma over its sovereign wealth fund. Norway has a $1.8 trillion sovereign wealth fund derived from its oil and gas income. The fund owns the equivalent of 1.5% of all shares in the world's listed companies, with holdings in nearly 9,000 of them. Its ethical guidelines require responsible investment, that is, not investing in weapons-making companies, tobacco companies, and companies that ruin the environment. But now, with Europe having to bear the full weight of support for Ukraine, pressure is rising in Norway to use the wealth fund for weapons. We are currently facing the most serious security crisis since World War II. There is an urgent need for increased investment in the Western defense industry to safeguard our own security and that of our allies, said the deputy leader of Norway's Conservation Party. The leader of one of Norway's opposition parties said in an interview, quote, "It's hypocritical. We are a NATO member. We are very dependent on the security that the U.S. can give us. We buy equipment from the same companies, that is to say those that make weapons, but we can't invest in them." Next, pressure on international students in the U.S. intensifies. Over 1,000 international students' visas have been revoked, and now the Chronicle of Higher Education reports that over 4,700 international student records in the Federal Student and Exchange Visitor Information System database have been terminated since President Trump took office. More than 180 colleges have told students their records have been terminated from the Federal Immigration Database in recent weeks. Most likely, the reason has to do with participation in political protests, expressing political views, or minor legal infractions. Once a student's records have been terminated, she may be subject to deportation at any time and without due process. The U.S. Treasury Secretary calls for changes in the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and trade with China. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on Wednesday called for major overhauls to the missions of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, but said that the U.S. remained committed to maintaining its leadership role at these global economic institutions. Quote, "Far from stepping back, America First seeks to expand U.S. leadership in international institutions like the IMF and World Bank. The IMF was once unwavering in its mission of promoting global monetary cooperation and financial stability. Now it devotes disproportionate time and resources to work on climate change, gender, and social issues," he said. As for the World Bank, he said that the bank should be technically neutral and prioritize affordability in energy investment. In most cases, this means investing in gas and other fossil fuel-based energy production, said Bessent. In other cases, this may mean investing in renewable energy coupled with systems to help manage the intermittency of wind and solar. What he was really referring to is the need for the bank to start supporting nuclear energy. Bessent also spoke about the possibility of a trade deal with China. He caused a spike upward in the stock market when he said, quote, "I don't think either side believes that the current tariff levels are sustainable. This is the equivalent of an embargo and a break between the two countries on trade that does not suit anyone's interest," unquote. But he dismissed speculation that Trump is considering unilaterally lowering the tariffs that he has imposed on China ahead of any negotiations with Xi Jinping. He emphasized that any moves to de-escalate trade tensions would need to be mutual. A spokesman for China's foreign ministry said, quote, "If the U.S. truly wants to resolve issues through dialogue and negotiation, it should stop threatening and coercing and engage in dialogue with China on the basis of equality, respect, and mutual benefit." Trump's national security team is in disarray. A drastic reorganization of the State Department and chaos in the Defense Department focus attention on the problem of appointing incompetent people to key positions. Marco Rubio, as Secretary of State, has completely abandoned his supposed claim to be a spokesman for human rights. He unveiled a reorganization plan for the State Department that eliminates the office of the Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights. He said that office was, quote, a platform for left-wing activists to wage vendettas against conservative leaders, meaning autocrats like Bolsonaro in Brazil and Orban in Hungary. The U.S. Agency for International Development is a skeleton of the original. Regional offices, on Africa in particular, are likely to be greatly reduced. In a statement explaining these actions, Rubio called the State Department a, quote, bloated bureaucratic agency that is beholden to radical political ideology. Quite a McCarthyite charge, with no evidence to support it. Meantime, Pete Hegseth's reign at the Defense Department may be short-lived. The Signalgate incident apparently was not a one-off thing. The classified attack plans against the Houthis in Yemen were shared on Signal a second time with his wife, brother, and others who had no business seeing them. Three people in Hegseth's inner circle were accused of leaks and escorted from the Pentagon. They defended their integrity in an unusual public statement. Those incidents appear to be the tip of the iceberg. Reports keep coming in of spreading dissatisfaction with Hegseth's leadership among military and civilian officials. Finally, a Trump gold card for millionaires. Another gift to the wealthy, this time those abroad. Buy your way to permanent U.S. residency with a $5 million Trump-embossed gold card. Such a steal. So here's the way it works in Trump's America. If you're here with a green card or a permanent residency or on a J-1 or F-1 visa, you may or may not have to worry about being deported. But if you have $5 million to spend on a Trump gold card, you are welcome. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertoff. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo to discuss the Spring Anthology Volume 1 issue of the paper. Welcome, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. For folks who may not know, what is the Spring Anthology for Street Roots?
Spring Anthology is our annual look back at kind of our some of our most impactful or important stories. There are, of course, a lot more than we can fit in two papers, but we tried to pick five really good ones for this week and five really good ones for next week.
Well, I'm excited to talk through some of these stories together. First one is from back in May of 2024. It's called A Tragic Comedy of Errors. You worked on this story with correspondent Tara Bennett. Tell me about it.
Well, I believe I was on here to talk about this story when it came out last year. This is a piece looking at a court case in which Rapid Response BioClean, which is the city's private for-profit sweep contractor that it hires to sweep homeless encampments. There was a wrongful death lawsuit against that company alleging that they seized and disposed of Debbie Ann Beaver's medication during a sweep in 2019. A week later, Debbie passed away, and the lawsuit alleges that her death was the result of losing her medication. So the story is really looking at kind of what happened after the lawsuit was filed, which initially, after it was filed in 2021, Rapid Response never responded to it in court. So a judge ultimately entered a default ruling in the case in favor of Debbie's family. After Street Roots reported on that default ruling, Rapid Response was reminded of the story, partially because, as far as I know, it's because we reached out to the city for comment, who then kind of, I guess, passed that along to Rapid Response. But this story is really looking at the response after that point, which was to ask a judge for a do-over in the case. They initially said they were never notified, but then records were found proving that they'd been notified about the case, at which point they said they just forgot about it. And, you know, to that point, maintained that they never swept Debbie's encampment, they never took her medication, which they've never changed their story on that. But this article that we're talking about right now came out about a week before they settled the case. And, you know, I think kind of the big piece of information that we found that was not in court records and had not been previously reported was that city records indicated Rapid Response had swept a camp consistent with Debbie's location in the time frame that they alleged that Rapid Response swept her.
I do remember that story. I remember a lot of these stories. So I'm glad we get to reflect on them. Another investigative piece featured in this issue is one called Banned Ex-Cops Patrol Oregon University Campuses. What did that article turn up?
This story originally came out in June of 2024, but, you know, it started by Sam Becker, a freelance reporter in Southern Oregon at the time, finding that Southern Oregon University employed a special campus security officer is the title, but employed somebody as a special campus security officer who had received a lifetime ban from law enforcement or security activity from the state's licensing and standards board for police and security. We then kept digging and found other universities were employing these special campus security officers who similarly had lifetime bans. And then Sam went to the law and discovered that Oregon's law had a loophole in it that for this position, the only one in the state that could essentially universities could hire them to police their students without doing a thorough background check of these positions. And, you know, if you're talking about folks who are working as security guards or things like that, they have to be certified by DPSST. So it's a really interesting kind of loophole that existed in the law.
Well, Jeremiah Hayden's reporting on the Supreme Court decision to overturn the Grants Pass v. Johnson case is also in this issue. Why was that one important to include?
Yeah, I mean, this one was tough because Jeremiah wrote so many great stories about Grants Pass versus Johnson. And, you know, we knew we needed to include at least one, but it was really hard to pick. So we did pick the one covering the ruling in the case, which, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that it is constitutional to arrest people and cite them for being homeless, essentially, you know, providing legal cover for criminalization of homelessness. I mean, I think this story really shows just how much work Jeremiah put into reporting on this case. I mean, he followed it for a year. Prior to this, he's still following it, you know, because there's, of course, kind of ongoing fallout in Grants Pass. But, you know, I mean, Jeremiah traveled to D.C., he traveled to Grants Pass, and it put him in this position that when the verdict, when the ruling was handed down, Jeremiah was one of the first people to have a story up about it. And I think it is still the best story I've read about this case. And I think it is just so thorough and shows all of the sourcing and all of the research that Jeremiah had done to that point. So where I think you could read this and, you know, understand a decade of legal history. Honestly, more than that, you know, like the cases that were relevant go back to the 60s. So, yeah, I just think it's a really excellent piece and really shows just how much work Jeremiah put into covering this topic.
The issue also includes Kimberly Cortez's investigation into affordable housing in Portland that's supported by the city's inclusionary housing program. What did she find?
She found that almost 30% of the units that were created under inclusionary housing can be rented within $6 of what HUD considers fair market rate. 95% of the units that have been created under inclusionary housing are only affordable to people making about $50,000 a year or more, up to $66,000 a year, which is 149% and 199% of full-time minimum wage in Portland. You know, I think this story is just really important because, you know, the city invests a lot of money in this program with the goal of addressing the lack of affordable housing. It gets kind of mentioned in the city's efforts to reduce homelessness. And, you know, I think when you look at the data and you look at how the program actually functions, it becomes very clear that it's not really addressing low-income housing. It's not addressing homelessness. It really is tailored to middle-income earners.
Well, this issue also includes a letter from the editor, from you, that talks about Street Roots, talks about the broader media landscape and where Street Roots fits in. Can you talk me through some of your thinking of what you're observing in the broader landscape, both in the U.S. and in Portland, and how the work that Street Roots does fits in?
Yeah, I don't think I'm telling anybody anything they don't know when I say that there's been a huge decline in local media, and that's a very big problem for a number of reasons, especially with things like misinformation and political polarization, because as local media has evaporated, Portland's fortunate to have the media that it does, but there's certainly, you know, if you look at the for-profit outlets, they have much smaller staffs than they did 15 years ago. And as local media has declined, people go looking for new sources of information and they end up finding it in less credible places. And that's, you know, that, and they're not, you know, the public is not unaware of that, right? If you look at data, it shows that the vast majority of news consumers feel that local news outlets are by far the most trustworthy. And that is even true for conservatives and Republicans who, you know, when you look at the data, they tend to be the most critical of the media, or say the most often say the media is not trustworthy, but even they are much more likely to feel trust in their local media. So, you know, there's kind of this multifaceted problem where there's less of the source that folks feel is most trustworthy. And of course, you know, with cable TV news and misinformation on social media, there's a lot more bad information that people find much more available to them. And outlets like Street Roots are very important in local media landscapes because the type of journalism that Street Roots does is the most time consuming, it's the most difficult, it's the most expensive, and it's, you know, oftentimes the most controversial, right? Because we're holding powerful people accountable. And that's the exact type of journalism that for-profit outlets have reduce their investments in over the last couple decades, investigative journalism. So we're in this kind of unique place where it's our priority is investigative journalism. So we're able to write stories that other outlets don't have the time for. You know, even though we are the smallest staff of any news outlet in Portland, I think the work that we've done has certainly had an impact on various pieces of legislation. Like we talked about Sam Becker's piece, there's a bill that is a direct result of that reporting that has already passed the Oregon House and is likely to pass the Oregon Senate soon. It has widespread bipartisan support. There are situations like with Debbie's death, where it's possible that that lawsuit goes in a very different direction if Street Roots doesn't find that information and report it. And I mean, you know, the same I think is really true for when we're talking about crime and all of the systemic responses that a city has when it believes it's kind of under siege by criminal element. So I guess all to say, I think we're in this position that allows us to address pieces of misinformation. It allows us to fact check things that officials say that other outlets don't necessarily have the time to. And then hopefully other outlets are reading our work. And we certainly have seen when an outlet is covering a topic, we might write our kind of myth-busting story on it. And the next time they write about that topic, you can tell it's different the way they're approaching it. And I think that is kind of a soft impact of Street Roots, but I think it might honestly be the most important contribution that we have to the local media landscape.
Where can folks find a copy of this edition of the paper for themselves?
Well, most places where there's a lot of foot traffic, you will typically find a vendor grocery stores, things like that. And I would, as I always do, I really think folks should go buy this issue. It's in color. It's beautiful. It has really nice illustrated cover by Edo O'Donnell King, our editorial illustrator and designer, and a really nice back page as well.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I would encourage folks to, if you can, go buy it. If you can't, try to make sure that you read these stories, at least on our website, where everything is free to read. I think these are all still really important stories and really relevant, which, you know, it's part of why we pick the stories that we do. So it's not, you know, super old news or seems outdated. There's still a lot of really important work. And if you haven't read these stories, I would really encourage you to do so.
Now's a great time to catch up. Well, Kay, thank you so much for taking the time to talk us through this.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, speaking with me about the Spring Anthology Volume 1 issue of the paper. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz